please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Sydney from the Design for Living Group.
Hey, everyone. I'm Sid, and I am an alcoholic. Hey, everyone, and everyone on Zoom world. My sobriety date is October 15th, 1985, and my home group is Design for Living, and that's in Neptune, New Jersey. And we meet every Sunday at 7 p.m., and July 11th, we go live for the first time, which is really wonderful. And we also have a meeting in Asbury Park on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. So, yeah, 35 years sober. And it's a really long time, and I can't believe that I'm an old-timer. And it's just wild. I grew up here in AA. And, you know, what's really incredible is that in 35 years, with life on life's terms and all the things that can happen with life, the external things, you know, that I'm powerless over and have no control over, like parents dying, dogs dying, financial issues, health issues, romance issues, money issues, career issues, just things that happen that are unexpected and hurt and cause such great sadness. What an amazing thing that the obsession and compulsion to drink has never entered my mind. And, I mean, that truly is a miracle. And then on top of that, life on life's terms, when a man like me, throughout 35 years of sobriety, the real clincher, when I get in my own way, and in 35 years I can tell you that taking back my will, my self-will, my propulsion, creating a tornado in my life by my own behavior, and creating circumstances that really mess me up and put me in really uncomfortable situations, whether it's sexual, relationship, career, money. And even with that, the obsession and compulsion to drink has been lifted. And you know, when I think about it, when I think about life on life terms and all those situations of my own self-will or external things happening, how could that obsession and compulsion be lifted from my life? And what I really think, out of the many ingredients that I believe have kept me sober, I think that the primary thing, if I were asked, would be what it says and how it works. That nothing ensures me immunity from a drink than working with another alcoholic. And I have been blessed to have the willingness since I came into AA to always have sponsees, to years later when I went through the book, taking men through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and prior to that experience, always having sponsees, always working with others, always staying connected to the fellows, you know, phone calls. Actually, AA became my lifestyle. Most of my friends to this day are all AAers. Most of my social life from the very beginning are all AAers. And I really think that sponsorship and having those phone calls is really what's always kept me on the beam, even when I rested on my laurels, when prayer and meditation wasn't working, when making the coffee wasn't working, when going to meetings wasn't working. And no matter how depressed or disintegrated my emotional sobriety may have been, and whether I'm a tornado in my own life, creating a, being a tornado in other people's life, the fact that I would get a phone call from another alcoholic or have the responsibility to take an alcoholic through the big book and always keep that appointment, I think, is a very strong part of what keeps me sober today. And throughout all this thing we call life. So, like many people's stories, I think that so many of us, but I'll speak, of course, for myself, there were traumas in my life as a child, growing up as a teenager. You know, there was this sense of feeling separate and different, and there were actually aspects of my life that were sort of different than the majority of the people that I was around. So as a small boy, my parents were Holocaust survivors, and in many ways, that sort of trauma and post-traumatic stress syndrome that they went through, I think, is sort of inbred in my DNA, that I was born with that trauma already in me, you know, and being a child of Holocaust survivors and growing up in a milieu of American children, families, you know, their parents weren't that, and it made me feel so different and unique. And also, even though as a young child I didn't know, and as an early teen I didn't know that I was gay, I knew that something was up and that I was different. And I knew that there was a societal message out there that whatever I was not cool with most of the world. And so the fear and the anxiety and the masks that I wore and adapted to sort of survive and push through this young adulthood and teenage years, when I took that first drink, my goodness, whatever was going on in the DNA, whatever was going on in those cells, that alcohol just washed it away. That the way we drink water today, because if we're told that it just irrigates our bodies, and if we have the flu or a cold and we drink that water, it goes into all our cells and we flush it out. And that drink, right away, I knew that that was flushing out fear, anxiety, and there was an ease and comfort to moving through life and socializing that I had never experienced before. And of course, I truly believe that, like the doctor's opinion, and that I have an allergy, right? And we're taught that not only is my body allergic to alcohol, that once I put it in my body, I'm going to want more and more. And even without it, that the mental obsession will always be there. And throughout my drinking, no matter what the consequences were, no matter what trouble I got into, I had a huge problem with denial. I'm one of those people who never, ever looked at alcohol as a problem. It was not an issue. You were the problem, or the things that I wanted, or the things that I didn't have and needed to get and couldn't, or where my feet were all in the wrong place, and that was the problem. And regardless, as the years passed by, whatever the consequences, I never dreamed that it was alcohol or acknowledged that. As a matter of fact, there were examples of a teacher coming over to me and asking me if I have a drug and alcohol problem. I was at the height of my alcohol and drug addiction. But when she asked me that, I really thought that she was crazy, you know, and I couldn't understand why she was saying this to me, because, you know, clearly I don't have a problem, and I just thought it was really odd. Another thing was I was invited to an engagement party, and they were fair weather friends from the bar, and at this party, the host and his new bride-to-be asked me to join their table to have some lunch. And one of the guests, who knew me from the bar, shouted out, he'd rather drink his lunch. And I thought that was the most bizarre thing, that this guy would say that about me. Because, I mean, you would say that to an alcoholic. Denial ran deep. As a matter of fact, it's only really maybe the last month or the last few days before I entered recovery is when I began to think that alcohol may be a problem. And so I'm the type of person where I went to college when I started drinking when I was 13. It was really a summer thing. The hangovers I experienced as a 13, 14, 15-year-old, 16-year-old, 17-year-old was more of a binge drinking thing that would happen on the weekends. The hangovers were atrocious. I would imagine that any civilian who experienced that type of hangover would probably never drink that way again, but I always swore that it felt too painful and I wouldn't, but of course the drink was in my hand the next weekend. When I went away to college at the age of 18, my girlfriend at the time, she drank the way I did, and both of us, we threw away our alarm clocks into the garbage pail, and I used the next year and a half at college like a hotel. And my parents had no clue, and they were pumping money into the student union, and I would go cash those checks, and I slept away the days and lived by night. And so I blew away a golden opportunity for an education that was paid for by my parents. And I was directionless, lost. There was a soul sickness so deep. But the adaptation of masks and moving through life with alcohol as a solution made things appear as if they were manageable. It was 1977, and the year I was now 18 and a half, and many of you are young and may not have heard of this place, and maybe some people who are older. The famous Studio 54 opened, and I was asked to attend with a friend, and I went, and the glamour and the status and the celebrities and the booze, I had arrived. So I left college to go to Studio 54, and there my life turned into another kind of bottom. You know, the drinking was unmanageable. The consequences weren't so great at 18 and a half, but there was that sort of feeling of hopelessness, being less than, watching these people, wanting to be like them, feeling like, what am I going to do with my life? And drinking just helped push that all away. And I would, you know, I became a sort of a party boy in New York City. And you know, I'm not going to spend so much time on my story, though it's a fabulous one, the Drunkalot. And, you know, I then, went away, to visit friends in Florida for a Christmas holiday, and on a drunken evening, at 19 years old, I met another 19-year-old guy and fell in love under the influence of pills and booze. And even though I had just left college, and even though I convinced my parents that, you know, things were going to be different and, you know, I'm going to, like, get a career and all that, now a Geographic was going to be the thing that would cure me. And I didn't know him well, but he lived in San Francisco, and I moved to San Francisco to be with him. And when he picked me up at the airport, he took me to a bar in the afternoon, like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a place called Busby's, and I had my first afternoon drink. And why I say that is because I was never up in the afternoon. And, you know, there it was. I mean, I couldn't believe it, the feeling of once again that I had arrived. The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, San Francisco, everyone was gay. And I was, you know, not out of the closet. And this was just amazing. And once again, I had arrived. My drinking escalated to such a point where all the beautiful clothes that my mom and I shopped for my new journey, you know, for a career in the San Francisco and hopefully Los Angeles area, disappeared. I don't know where the hell it went, but I quickly, the proportions, the lengths where my drinking took me, I found myself on the streets of San Francisco and Salvation Army lines, and I did things for drinking that I never thought that someone with my upbringing and the value system that I had would do. And my lifestyle was a very dangerous and creepy lifestyle in San Francisco, and alcohol took me there. I had a moment of clarity, and I returned after a year to New York and to the bosom of my family's care. And I was unable to drink the way I had come to drink in my parents' home. And believe it or not, I was able, as many of us can, to manipulate them to get an apartment in the city, rent me an apartment in the city, because I told them that I was going back to San Francisco, and they were so fearful that I would, that my father rented me a small apartment in the city, but I had to work for a friend of my father's in order to have that happen. I was paid cash under the table. My electric bill, my phone bill, my rent, everything was taken care of by my parents. I didn't have a care in the world, nor did I care about that job, because with the pay that I would get from work, I was in the bars every evening. I was too drunk to show up to work, and of course I was let go, and my father pulled the plug on that apartment, and I was furious. But on my 22nd birthday, I was very, very drunk, and I met a man who was as old as my parents, and he was wealthy and lived on Park Avenue in Manhattan, and I moved in with him, and I didn't leave for many, many years, and you know, and once again I had arrived, and my drinking took on new proportions, because the lifestyle that he allowed me to live, I didn't have to work, and I was able to go to the bars and the nightclubs and all that sort of thing all night and come home at any time. And I literally slept away the days and lived by night. And, you know, the consequences for some of us can be grave when people pull the plug on finances or shelter and things like that. But I was greatly enabled by my parents, and I was gratefully enabled by this man. And I believe, possibly, I mean, it's speculation, of course, that if my parents had stopped funding me as well as he stopped funding me, I'd probably be on the street or dead, the type of life that I was living in San Francisco when I was really bottoming out and seeing sort of some of the darkest experiences of my bottom. The story goes on and on with so much like this. The you know, I'm going to fast forward it. You know, I had to end up working for my father. I couldn't show up for that at all. I mean, it was impossible. I was drunk, you know, every night and hungover in the morning and had to call in sick a million times. You know, I'd be sick in bed for 2 or 3 days. You know, if my mother had quadruple heart bypass surgery, I was incapable of showing up after she got out of the hospital to return, you know, at home to be a good son. When my best friend's father died, I was incapable of showing up to a funeral like that. And the type of relationships that I would have, you know, were just crazy and unmanageable. And one evening, coming home from work, restless, irritable, and discontent, I went into a bar. And I was only going to have one drink because I wasn't going to miss work the next day. And, of course, that turned into 6 or 8. And I went home with a stranger. And for the first time, my biggest never, ever, ever, ever would do this. But I shot up drugs. And it was a horrifying experience. And all of the track marks on my arms that evening really flipped me out. And I was walking home 6 in the morning and through Central Park looking at my arms, and I knew, you know, something's wrong, something has got to give, and I would have to be at work at 7, which would be impossible. And so I called my brother for the millionth time to tell him that I would not be able to come to work. But this time, I ran out of excuses. And for some reason, though it was a lie, I said, I can't come to work because I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And he said, oh, okay, we'll help you. So I went to an outpatient facility for 3 months and group therapy. one individual, group twice a week. I heard tons of solution of making phone calls, the allergy, all this sort of stuff. And at the end of each month, I would go to the bar armed with all this knowledge and order a ginger ale. And by the, you know, half hour in, I was drinking again. And each time I came back to that group therapy, they told me that if I don't go to AA, they would kick me out of the group, because all of the group members in that clinic were AAers. So I went to my first AA meeting, and actually that was in October 15th, 1985, and I chose that date because it was Columbus Day weekend, and I wasn't going to give up, you know, that long holiday, you know, of partying. And I came into AA, and wow, and I stayed. I mean, it's really unbelievable. I did all the beginner things that one is told, you know. You know, when people knock the 90 days and all that, you know, I don't understand why anyone even has to go there. It's like I went to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I inundated myself with people's stories, you know, and it's because of all of your stories that I was sitting there that you guys busted the denial that I was in. I truly believed, even going to that AA meeting, that it was really just the last month or two or three that were the problem, and that perhaps my drinking got out of hand. And it was by going to those 90 meetings in 90 days and really listening to you guys and getting phone numbers and actually calling you guys that I was able to have my story evolve, and understanding that even prior to a drink, the feelings of soul sickness, separateness, hopelessness, jealousy, envy, were all riddled within me, and that the solution, the ease and comfort of a drink, of course made sense at the age of 13. And so that's where I learned that, and I quickly got service positions, and then in time got sponsees. In that period, in 1985, in Manhattan, there weren't really a lot of big book meetings. It was more 12 and 12, things like that. It became more trendy, you know, in the recent years. I'm sure across the United States there were groups that were doing it, but I'm sure you've heard old timers like me talk about that, that it really wasn't, you know, very, very popular. And I got sober, you know, and life was wonderful. I mean, you know, I went back to college, you know, and I graduated with honors. I opened up businesses. I was able to hold my mother in my arms when she died. I was available. You know, I had relationships. You know, I ended up having boyfriends, long-term relationships, and those breakups would occur with some civility and grace. You know, and I didn't drink over those things. There were many wonderful, really, truly wonderful things that occurred all throughout sobriety. I was available, and I was available for my partner's death, and as well, and my dogs, and you know, and really just being a human being, and of course, the most important thing, helping others, you know, and trying to practice these principles in all my affairs. But as the years went on, I began to rest on my laurels, you know, and what happened for me was I had this great AA face, you know. I knew hundreds and hundreds of people in AA, you know, because I had a lot of time, and I'm a social person, you know, and when people like me, like you like me, and, you know, and what would happen is that it ended up kind of maybe being like that cliche you hear, you know, that, you know, it's like that 1 hour in the meeting, you know, everything is good. But when I go home, you know, and I'm alone, sort of the double life begins to occur again. And at 25 years sober, I began to have this great AA face with all of you. But behind closed doors, there was so much worry and fear. And my sex life was out of control. My money life was out of control. I didn't like where I was with my career, you know. And there was this sort of restless, irritable, and discontent brewing in me. And of course, having that much time, you know, I would tell my close friends in AA this sort of stuff, and maybe 10% to my sponsor because I didn't want to hear it, you know. And so everything was really eating at me. And I decided to go back to big book meetings. And, you know, and I was looking at the people in the room, you know, in this big book study meeting, and they were all sharing. And once again, you know, the sort of reminiscence of, you know, people who were really sort of spiritually connected and, you know, sort of fresh-faced. And, you know, I was at a point where I was having lost weekends online, looking for love in all the wrong places, you know, where I wasn't picking up a drink with a lost weekend like many of us had, but like, you know, I was wasting my time with all these sprees, these pursuits, that were robbing me of spirit, you know, draining me of good orderly direction, bringing me further away from conscious contact with a higher power, you know, how can you pray, you know, I would kind of be like, well, how can I pray, you know, if I'm looking for love online? It's just going to ruin it, you know? I mean, it was just such a messed up head. And so I asked a man who was really passionate about the steps and the big book to take me through it. And, you know, line by line. And at 25 years sober, I mean, I had done a fourth step when I had 4 years sobriety, but it was a very different process in those days, the way I went through the steps and even the amends that I made. And I always had a higher power, but this was different. This was a very sort of diligent, thorough, line-by-line experience. And I can tell you that at 25 years sober, you know, there was a sort of an awakening, you know. I became lit up again, and the blockage, you know, was beginning to be removed. When I took that first step, you know, in looking at my life at 25 years sober, I was very many, many, many years away from a drink already, and not that someone with my amount of time couldn't pick up, but I knew that it really wasn't about the drink. What I was powerless over and what was unmanageable were all the sprees in my life, my attitude, the way, my behavior, the sprees and the things that I was doing. And so I was able to incorporate that new experience of 25 years with the first step to look at those things. And so I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And that sanity was the same thing that when I came into AA. You know, the sanity isn't that we were insane because of our story and the consequences and the crazy situations we got into. All insanity means is being restored to sanity just means that I know the truth about myself, that I can never drink like a normal person. And that means I'm sane. If I can internalize that and truly understand that, that means I've been restored to sanity, that I know my truth, that a drink in me means death or consequences. And so looking at my life, I understood that now, at 25 years, there were lots of behaviors that were, that I was dishonest with myself, and that, of course, I'm unhappy. And so I made that decision, you know, and when I got on my knees with my sponsor and did that third step prayer, I wept at 25 years. And then I launched into a fourth step, and can you imagine, sober, 25 years, the amount of resentments that I had built up in 25 years, it was unbelievable experience. And of course, to see that it was all me, all along, nobody else, just me. And that was a very, very powerful experience, telling him that in the fifth step. And with six and seven, of course, you know, I really understood my character defects. My sponsor was more than happy to point them out to me, as well as me recognizing them, you know, sitting across from the table. And of course, having 25 years of sobriety, I had touched that issue before, but, you know, they were so flaring in my life at this point that, man, you know, it was just a powerful experience to, you know, delve into that. For me, you know, when I was new, 6 and 7 was in the early days for me was more of like a conceptual thing. It was, and some people, I mean, some people feel that way too, you know, that it's about just knowing your defects of character and the simple thing of praying to God about them. And when they're lifted, they're lifted. You know, it's up to Him. And I can tell you that that has shifted for me. I mean, it doesn't have to be like that for you guys, but I'm saying for me it became a different thing. Because my group, when I was young in my 20s and early 30s and was dealing with my defects of character, you know, I would get on my knees and ask God, you know, can you please remove these defects of character, you know, and I would do it, you know, regularly. And of course, you know, some of them weren't lifted, and they actually, you know, none of them really were kind of lifted. And I would engage in all that behavior, you know, again, and, you know, I'd be like, you know, with my friends, well, you know, progress, not perfection, you know, it's like, you know, I did the prayer, you know, and what happened with me 25 years later was that 6 and 7 became an action step, not just in regard to the humility and the prayers to God, but it literally meant, for example, if love and looking for love in all the wrong places, it meant not getting on my knees and asking for these love sprees to be lifted from my life. It meant that there was also going to be an action, that I was going to delete those apps. You know, I was going to get off those websites, and that was me taking an action. And if it was about quitting smoking, it meant that when I bought a full pack, right, aside from the prayer, I would take that pack and put it under water and throw it in the garbage pail, and that was an action. Even though I went 20 minutes later to get another pack, but it was about living in action. Even with gossip, you know, there was a time where, you know, I prayed because I wanted to be super spiritual and not gossip, you know, like when you're at the diner and you guys later are going to talk about my qualification, that kind of thing, you know, and rip me under the coals. So, you know, I wanted that to be lifted. And so I would go to the diner, and like if guys were gossiping, I would say, hey, I'm working on my like 6 and 7, please don't gossip around me. And, you know, they all gave me the finger and said, well, get up and leave, you know. And, but, you know, I had that choice. I could get up and leave, right, or not participate. So 6 and 7 became about actually doing stuff. And, so 8 and 9, I made the list. I'm going to tell, how much time do I have?
It is 8:38. You're good.
Oh, good. Cool. So, you know, believe it or not, at step 8 and 9, when I told my sponsor, you know, the list, and he helped me with the list, there was a woman, there was a period when I was living with a guy where I ended up being involved with a woman, and she and I had a long year and a half affair, love affair. And I was leading a double life with her. She didn't know that I was living with a man. And only an alcoholic, right, can get away with all that kind of stuff, right? You know, I mean, no clue. And I was a tornado in this woman's life. I was an active, violent, emotionally abusive drunk to her, and kicking down her door. Her doorman banned me from the building, and I would sneak in. And I was just a horror show. My first sponsor, when I had 4 years of sobriety, told me that I should not contact her because it would do more harm than good. At 25 years sober, I sat across my Design for Living big book solution-based sponsor, and he said, yeah, of course you're going to call her. And I don't care, you know, where she is, but you're going to call her and you're going to make amends to her. And it's like, you know, it's like 20-something years ago. He says, well, you're going to do it. And anyway, I go. I get online, Facebook, Instagram, all the things, all social media. I cannot find her. I go to him and I say, I can't find her. And he says, well, you know, maybe she got married or something and moved away. All you can do is keep being in action, pray to God, you know, that she shows up and, you know, at least you looked. I'm walking down the street and I run into a guy and who knew her, and he I asked him about her, and he said, oh, she moved away a long time ago and got married, and she doesn't live in the state, and you remember how she disliked her family and she probably got rid of her maiden name. So I was like, ah, and I go back to my sponsor and I tell him, you know, this story, and he says, well, all you can do is pray. And so, you know, in my morning prayers and evening prayers, I pray for my eighth and ninth step list. And I go to dinner in the East Village in Manhattan on a spring night, Saturday night, with a program friend, and we're eating dinner, and we're talking about amends and all sorts of program stuff. And, you know, he asked me, how's that amends going, you know, with her? And I told him the story that, you know, she's nowhere to be found. And, but, you know, that I've been praying about that. Anyway, you know, we pay our bill, and I open the door to the restaurant, and there she is, right there. And not to the right, and not to the left, but dead center, with her back towards me. But I know it's her. And she's circled with about 15 or 20 women. And I just know that it's her. And for some reason, she turns around and she says, Sydney. And I say, Julia. And I approached her and I said, may I ask you something? And I made an appointment to meet with her the next day, which she accepted to have lunch. She was living in North Carolina, and she came to Manhattan with 20 women to see a Broadway show for the weekend, which is way uptown. The odds of her being there at that time, I mean, sometimes God really throws you a bone. You know, when that happened, I cannot tell you how my faith and trust was just boosted, you know, ignited in me, like, you are really there. Thank you for showing me this. Thank you for presenting her. You know, and I was just, you know, lit on fire with that. And the amends process sitting with her was really, really incredible. And, you know, very powerful. I have found that many of the amends that I have made, were not only, to free me, you know, of the bondage and the fear and the anxiety of running into these people or having deep shame or humiliation or guilt lifted from my life. But one of the beautiful surprises was to see these changes in the eyes of the people making amends too. And sometimes it's an extremely beautiful experience that I've encountered for it to be ending up being a spiritual experience for both people. One of the amends that I made was to a partner who we had gone out for 4 years and broken up, and I made the amends, and they had told me at the end of the amends, the way I do it, you know, is where, you know, we make the amends, and then after I make the amends, I ask if there's anything I left out. Is there something else that you'd like to tell me that I may be omitting or forgetting? And then they say it, and then afterward, I was taught to say nothing, and then just ask if there's anything I can do to make it right. So when I made amends to this old flame, they proceeded to tell me a list of things that you guys just have to believe me with this, is that that I didn't do, you know, and I wasn't sure, because I was sober those years, there weren't something outrageous, but, you know, I hadn't done them. And I don't know what was going on in his life at that time, where that kind of storytelling would come up. Every instinct in my body wanted to say, please, you know, let me remind you that this is not what happened. You know, you're thinking of someone else, you know, because it's, I think, just human instinct. But what occurred was the instructions of my sponsor and the way my home group makes the amends. And though it was eating at me at that table to hear him say these things that I hadn't done, I just kept silent and let him say it. And at the end, I asked if there's anything I can do to make it right, the things that I hadn't done. And he said, well, you know, I don't think we should be in contact. I don't think we should be friends, you know, and because you've made a good attempt at amends, I don't want this to be a significant friendship anymore. And the beautiful thing about that amends is that that is really both. It is really what both of us needed. We needed God to intervene and break that codependency relationship of years ago, but that was mired in those holiday greetings and the sort of superficial, you know, conversations and checking in that were always distraught, I believe, for me, but also for him. And through that amends process, though, it wasn't favorable, if you will, in my thinking mind in the beginning. It brought us to, both of us, to a place where it needed to be, and that was separate and out of each other's lives. I have an immense story where someone asked me and told me of lifetime of irresponsible money issues between us, you know, where borrowing money and lending money from both of us prior to sobriety, prior, you know, in the active days, was always just vague and not written down and, you know, just a mess. And I had sold a piece of property and they found out about it and they asked me for money that they believed that they said I owed them. And I asked them, well, how do I owe this to you? Like, from what? You know, remind me. And he had no clue, you know, and, well, you know, even though I had just gone through all those steps, you know, you're not taking my money, you know? And it's like, you know, well, what do you mean you don't know? You know? And, so I brought that to my sponsor. And, you know, my sponsor and I talked about it and, he understood that there was a vague situation between us in regard to money for a lifetime and that the money that I did get was really not mine because it was an inheritance piece of property and that it was a gift, if you will. And he just turned to me, my sponsor, and said, you know, well, what do you want to be, right or do you want to be free? Do you want to be right or do you want to be free? And you know what? I wrote that check. I wrote it, and I gave it to him, and something shifted. Resentments, more bonding occurred between him and his family, and it was a gift. And so with 10, 11, and 12, I can tell you that these are the things that when I'm on the beam and I really live in 10, 11, and 12. My life is so much more smooth. Things go better and I'm much happier. I'm less of living in defects of character. I'm less of a tornado in people's lives. My emotional sobriety is more in touch with the serenity and the peace that I've experienced in 35 years of sobriety, of course not all the time, but, you know, sobriety is the only time that I've ever experienced peace and serenity. So the most difficult thing for me in 10, 11, and 12 is the discipline that I have with my sponsees and taking men through the book is always intact. And that service, I believe, keeps me away from a drink. But for me, I'm an extremely undisciplined man. And as I get older and seem to have more time, there really seems to be many more, issues that come up in my mind that make me restless, irritable, and discontent. And I guess it could be any one of us with any amount of time, but a lot of like, is that all there is? Is like, what is going to happen to me? How much longer am I going to live? Like, will the money, last? Will I become infirmed? And then just, relationship stuff and things like that. And what I find is that when I do a nightly review and I look at that kind of stuff, all the adversity in my life becomes manageable. And when I pray and meditate, as it says at the end of the 11th step, it works. It really does. And it's really that simple. Every day I wake up and it's a choice. Either I'm going to live a life, I'm going to go in this direction, which is a life of self-will, self-propulsion, sprees of some kind, or I'm going to choose a spiritual day where I'm really going to wake up and get on my knees and pray. I'm going to do upon awakening. I'm going to call fellows in the program. I'm going to go to a meeting, and I'm going to pray at night, and I'm going to do that kind of thing. And I'm always faced with that every day. And what's my choice to be? And many days I don't do that. And that turns into maybe a week or two or three, and the tapestry of my sobriety begins to unravel. Or that cashmere sweater or a wool sweater with the pull, it may look beautiful or look good or sound good, but that pull is there and it's going to unravel. I'm going to tell you something about a higher power. When I came into AA and my first few meetings, I turned to the sponsor I had at that time. And I remember when he said, and I asked him, how will the obsession and the compulsion to drink be lifted? I hear all you guys talking about that. Like, when will that go away? And he said to me, well, do you believe in God? And being a people pleaser, I, said, oh, yeah, of course. And I just could not believe that this dude said this to me. I was like, what have I gotten myself into? Where am I? Like, is this some religious program? And he said, I want you to go home every evening and I want you to say, God, please remove the obsession and compulsion to drink and drug from my life. And then I want you to do it in the morning. And I said, oh, of course. And as I was leaving the meeting, I knew that I would never, ever say those prayers. And for some reason that evening, with maybe 11 days or 17 days in AA, I found myself honest, open, and willing for some reason, getting on my knees and saying that. And I then said it in the morning, and then the next day, in the evening and the morning, and so on and so on. And I believe that though a huge part of me didn't believe, but the fact that I was honest, open, and willing to take that action from someone in Alcoholics Anonymous and trust and just have faith, that that little mustard seed of willingness began to pour and lay a foundation that may have very well have kept me here till this day. So thank you so much, Shay, for asking me to come down and speak. This is such a lovely group, and what a gift to come 2 hours on a beautiful ride in such a gorgeous setting with fireflies and countryside. I've really enjoyed this, so thank you.